All right, then. Before we go on, I just want to point out that intention is actually built into the 12 steps in several places. The third step, when it says we turned our will and our lives over, is talking about intention. Our will is our intention. It's like Buddhist corollary to, you know, the motivation, the thing. So we're trying to align our intention with our higher power, or in Buddhism, with the Dharma. In step six, being entirely ready means that we have set our intention to let go. Entirely ready to have God remove our defective character means we're really ready to change, to grow. We're pointing in that direction. Step eight is very specific. It says we made a list of those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. Again, setting intention. It separates, it actually has separate steps for intention from the action. Step six is a separate step. In step three, it's not a separate step, although step two could also be called an intention setting step. So there's kind of this wisdom in that, in the steps, that correlates with Buddhist teachings, and that they would actually set a separate step to set intention, really shows the importance of that. Because in Buddhism, you know, the means and the end are not separate things. It's seen that whatever we bring to, whatever the quality of our actions and whatever's behind our actions is really going to color the results. It's like this idea that, oh, we'll go to war in order to bring peace. You know, as though that could happen. You can't bring peace by war. I'll lie in order to, you know, accomplish some good. You know, the truth will come out if I lie. So we have to, watching your intention is a key element in Dharma practice. It's there's several different aspects of practice, maybe many different, but certainly several that require this mindfulness as kind of a overarching view. So with right effort, we need to be mindful of the effort. With right intention, we need to be mindful of the intention. Because we so easily deceive ourselves. Right? So just saying, oh, I want to be happy. But then we look at, well, what are we really doing? How are we living? What do we, you know, the oh, I meant to do it. You know, I have a teenage daughter, so she says that a lot. You know, I meant to. But of course, if she had meant to, she would have. And that's kind of the telling sign of whether intention was really what we said it was. And it's easy to deceive ourselves about intention. It's easy to have that feeling, well, I meant to do it, but this is what one of the reflections that's so important. So it's easy to think that I want to be happy, but then spend all your time at work, you know, or whatever your thing is that you feel obligated to do, to take care of everybody else, or, you know, whatever it is that's kind of not really making you happy, but you think that you have to put it first. And I mean, obviously, we live in a world in which there's a lot we have to do that we don't necessarily want to do. Work being one of them for many people. And so, it's not like we can just ignore reality. Well, my intention is to be happy, and I'm just happy when I'm walking around in the country, so I'm going to spend the rest of my life walking around in the country. It's not that simple, obviously. But we can see how if I keep this if I have an intention for happiness, I'm going to look for ways to be happy in whatever kind of situation it is. It doesn't even necessarily mean that I have to change what I'm doing as much as it means changing my attitude toward it. You know, there are many forms of work that it might not be, you know, you're following your bliss kind of work, but a shift in attitude about what you're doing. I was actually talking to someone the other day about this, because we had both been technical writers, you know, working for software companies, writing user manuals. And we both had the experience, because he was a Buddhist practitioner as well, of sort of investigating the question of livelihood, of right livelihood, at a certain point in our work, and realizing that what we were doing, if viewed properly, I think, viewed from a Dharma perspective, what we were doing was doing service for people who needed to know how to operate these software programs. And that if that was my orientation when I was working at this, it was much more enjoyable to me. When it was just this drudgery of kind of dry documentation, you know, click here and, you know, look at this screen or whatever, it seemed kind of meaningless and tedious. But when I thought of it as, oh, there's somebody who needs this and I'm doing service for them, that completely shifted how I thought of it. I'm not going to say that, you know, overnight I became like, oh, I can't wait to go to work. But there was something meaningful for me. And I think we can do that. There's a lot of things we can do that with by shifting just our attitude and, again, shifting our intention rather than necessarily shifting the action. And sometimes we'll realize, well, the intention behind that thing I'm doing is not helpful or it's not skillful. It's not leading to happiness. And so, yeah, I need to change that action as well. Well, maybe I should have said all that before you did the exercise. Anyway, interested to hear any reflections. Yes?
I might just be very negative, but this was really hard for me. I feel that my go-to, especially if I am not going to meetings every single day and doing what I'm supposed to be doing, automatically reverts to negative, you know, beating myself up, just all the negative things that I, before I came into the program and started really working on myself, it's like what I learned my whole life growing up. Mm-hmm. So this was really hard for me to, like, I've never set an intention for happiness.
Yeah. So, first of all, mind if I ask you, like, how long you've been sober for? 1 year? Okay. And I say that because I think at different stages we have different capacities and different focuses. I mean, I think it's good that you feel like you need to get to a meeting every day because you're at a year. I was the same way. And as I said before, I'm not the same. So I think it's also important to see you're not necessarily going to have to go to a meeting every day for the rest of your life, although some people will debate that question. But you're laying a groundwork. One of the things that I think is so hard for people, for addicts, for us as addicts, is our expectation that things should happen quickly in our time. I'm not quite answering, but I'm going to come back to what you're saying. We think, well, I should do this and this, and then that should happen. You know, and especially with spiritual or personal growth, it has its own time. You know, it's got its own arc that we can't control. I mean, I remember, you know, when I went on my first retreat, I was like, I'm going to go on a retreat for 5 days, man. When I come out of there, I'm going to be such a good meditator, and it's just everything, you know, I'm going to be so blissed out. I came out of there and I cried for a week afterwards. I was like, what happened? I was supposed to be, I was supposed to be enlightened by now. A year after that, and this was before I got sober, so I kind of had these misguided ideas about what spiritual practice was. I was like, now I'm going to go on a 3-month retreat, and when I get out of that retreat, I'm going to be so enlightened. You know, and I got out of there, and I was like, I was homeless, my girlfriend had broke up with me, I didn't have a job, and I just got really depressed. And, you know, that was my time frame. It's like 3 months. I mean, come on, what do you want from me? You know, that should be enough to fix me. So when I look at sobriety, I look at it in kind of about 5-year increments. You know, the first 5 years, I think, are like the first serious. I mean, definitely the first 30 days and the first 90 days, and all those are important. But in terms of real significant long-term change to have the life that you want and to, for your life to change, 5 years is about the first. Well, there was a 2-year thing, but anyway, 5 years, 10 years. You know, at 10 years, my life was really different. You know, and so it's really tough for us because we're used to, like, give me a drink, I feel better already. You know, that's great. You know, I have to wait 30 days to feel better. I have to wait a year, 5. What's he talking about? You know, I haven't got time for that. So that's one of the big letting goes. You know, that's why they say one day at a time. Because really, all the rest of that, you know, I can't see that far in the future, you know. So, but let's come back to, I just want to ask you, what was so hard about
it? Well, I feel like, you know, growing up, that was always how I protected myself.
What was how you protected yourself?
Just negativity, the victim, okay. Playing the victim, I think.
So instead of thinking about being happy, you just were like...
And helping other people and doing good things and happiness, it's always just like, I get people's attention by complaining and uh-huh. being the victim and being yeah. negative. And, you know, I see that now.
Yeah.
But for some reason today, it was really hard because I just felt like happy. Like, it, you know.
Alien.
Yeah.
So this process, both of recovery and recovering joy, has to begin with the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. We can't change until we see the truth of how we are. And that's what we call insight. And one of the reasons we haven't been able to change is that it's painful to look at that, so we suppressed it and numbed it. And so, you know, this process, the 12-step process, you know, writing that inventory, sharing that, making the amends, all that stuff, seeing the wounds, it's not easy. That's why there's a community to be with, because you can't, I don't think you can do that alone, you know. You really can't. You got to have people around you who are going to say, you're going to make it. It's okay. You're not alone. I've been there. All of that. You know? And it's all true. You know, you can make it. You will make it. You know, you're doing the hero's work. You're doing the work of the warrior. You know? And that's how real transformation happens. Yeah. Thank you. You know, and let me also say that it's not that we become different people or even get rid of those things. It's changing our relationship to them. One of the things I often wind up saying when people are like, I'm thinking too much when I'm meditating, I'm saying, it's not about stopping thinking, it's about changing your relationship to the thoughts. So part of it, so also in this practice in our growth is changing our relationship to our personality, you know, to the conditioning. It's like, that's just who I am, you know, as far as I can go in terms of like how solid that is. That there's, yeah, there's mood patterns and thought patterns that are just, they're deeply ingrained. But if I keep seeing them, and I know that there's another way to look at it, then I can pull myself out of them a little bit. I can step back from them. At times I'll be overwhelmed, but a lot of times I can remind myself, oh, there I go again. And that in itself is really different from just being lost in it. You know, having compassion for ourselves, having forgiveness for ourselves is so important on this path. So we're not going to turn into perfect people ever. You know, Ruth Dennison, another person who gives another great model of this. I don't know, have any of you ever heard of her before? A few of you, yeah. So Ruth was this crazy lady, she lives out in the desert in this ramshackle Dharma center, and you go out there on retreat, and she comes into the meditation hall with her two schnauzers, and she's just, and you're trying to meditate, and she just keeps talking the whole time. Like, lady, shut up, I'm trying to meditate. Just constantly guided meditation. She's just had this personality, and it didn't change. She didn't develop a different personality when she became enlightened. She just maybe became more of that personality. That's just who she was, and she wasn't ashamed of it. She was this big, controlling, lady. And she was brilliant. She was a great model for, I don't have to become some spiritual, quiet, whatever, holy person. I can be myself, and that's okay. That I just don't want to harm myself or harm others, and then I'm okay with the rest of it. Other thoughts about...
I think grief. Yeah. I saw Inside Out last night.
You saw what?
Inside Out.
Oh, you did. You saw Inside Out.
And it was a striking film. And as you were saying, the joy and sadness get lost.
That's right.
Headquarters or whatever.
Yeah,
it's
right.
And it's left with fear and... Disgust.
Right, disgust.
And anger.
Anger, yeah.
In the show.
Anger was great.
And I was sort of thinking how addiction could step in as a way of... But I was also interested, as you said earlier, about the role of sorrow, sadness, becoming more and more... And she stopped being just a nuisance. She actually became a key player and actually got the thing... back on the track again.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the idea of grief or the things that happened to us or didn't happen to us and that we'll never get. And I'm wondering whether actually that's as important as happiness. Mm-hmm. Or one can't happen without the other.
Right.
And there's a mourning process.
Yep.
And I don't know the 12-step, I don't know anything about it. Whether that's part of that.
Well, I absolutely think so. I think that, and it's kind of like the language isn't expansive enough somehow to contain what I mean when I'm talking about happiness, because it does include grief. I mean, my father died when I was a year sober, and so I experienced grief for the first time. It was the first time somebody really significant in my life had died. And what struck me was that I had spent a lot of time in my life being depressed, but that this was distinctly different from that. This felt natural, and actually it felt healing in a way, and cleansing, and rich, and meaningful. And what I got from that was that the depression I experienced was very self-centered, and it was self-created. It was just thinking about myself. I would have a feeling, and, you know, depression is complicated because there's a big biochemical, neural chemical part of it. But there's just that feeling, on top of the feeling is all this just hating yourself or just hating life or whatever. And with the grief, it was this sadness that came from something real, that wasn't me about me. It was the natural human experience of the parent dying. That's supposed to happen, you know. And it seemed, and maybe that's why it felt okay, because from an evolutionary sense, it fits in, you know. The thing that's not acceptable is when the child dies. You know, that's not quite so, you know, I don't think that's ever cleansing, horrible. But losing my father, it felt like this very natural, and I actually made an effort to let it keep coming up. I actually was reading a book by Stephen Levine at that time, and I would just read a little bit each night to allow myself to cry or to just feel the feelings, so to speak, you know, around losing my father. So that to me is part of happiness, you know, in the sense of an integrated, fully sort of a complete human being. But very different from that self-centered self-hatred and depression. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I wonder, apart from neurological stuff aside, but psychoanalytically, sort of the depression has failed at the moment. Sort of grief, proper grief that hasn't happened, becomes depression.
I'm having a little hard time understanding you.
Well, if you, everyone has losses and things that haven't happened to them, or childhood where they've been neglected, or something's gone.
Right.
No, there's no such thing as a happy childhood. And then it needs mourning, it needs grief.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't happen, then it becomes depression.
Right.
If it's happened into something.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think. I'm not sure what has to happen to it, but I think just in the larger sense of, it needs to be integrated, needs to be seen. And allowed to be there, rather than suppressed. Absolutely. Yeah.
Hi. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about intent? Because I don't think I think I had an intent.
Yeah.
I think I got it totally wrong. I think I understand in terms of intent, choice, action. Intent seems to precede choice.
Right.
Precedes action. But on its own, I don't quite know what intent is.
Uh-huh. Well, it has some different forms. There's a conscious intent, which is the thought, I want to do this because it's going to lead to that. So that's just the, you know, conscious intention. And then there is the impulse that's more reactive, that's more conditioned, that I'm doing this because subconsciously I think it's going to get this thing that I want. So that's like, I'm having this drink because I think it's going to make me happy. Or I'm going to try to sleep with this person because, you know, I have this craving and somehow I believe that it's going to fix me. And I'm just improvising right now. So, I mean, I'm just trying to answer your question, because I haven't thought about it particularly in the way you're asking. The the Buddhist teaching is that there is always an intention behind every thought, word, and deed. But that most of the time, the intention is unconscious. And that because the intention is unconscious, it's driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. The three poisons that, when we are unconscious, run us. You know, we either want pleasure, we want to get rid of something uncomfortable, or we're just not paying attention. That's greed, hatred, and delusion. When we are run by greed, hatred, and delusion, the karmic consequences are not good. So we want to keep reflecting on and looking at why am I doing this? What's the energy behind this? What's the impulse? What's the motivation? So is there something conscious or is there something unconscious? Is there something emotional that's pulling me for this? Is there some belief that's driving me? What's behind it? So it's a really critical question that we're asked to more or less constantly explore in Buddhism. And we can see how tied up this is with addiction. Because with addiction, clearly, we have the intention to feel good or to be happy or to bring ourselves pleasure or to just get rid of the pain. But the way we did that, so it might not have been an unskillful intention, but it was directed towards a fix rather than a process. Now we want to jump over the process. We want to cheat karma, okay? Because the law of karma is actions bring results. Happiness depends upon actions, and those actions are a process. Just as I was talking about before, about how it takes time. But with addicts, we don't have that kind of time. We're in a hurry. So we're going to fix it now with this shortcut. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work. Because I think I need to rewind that a little bit. Because the impulse, the intention isn't really happiness in the way that I'm defining it. You know, it's pleasure or the lack of discomfort. And when we just seek pleasure or to get rid of pain or to get pleasure, we are just being driven by that, by greed, hatred, and delusion. That's not pleasure. And one of the ways we get confused is pleasure with happiness. That's actually, again, something that our culture tells us. You know, drink this beer and you will be happy. Eat this food and you will be happy. Get this car and you'll be happy. Go on this holiday and you'll be happy. So those are all things that can bring pleasure, but they're not sources of happiness. Happiness comes from integrity, relationships, satisfying work, you know, and a rich inner life. The real things, which take real time and real effort to cultivate. Right. Well, there's that. You thought you intended that. Yeah.
Yeah, but that was what I thought an intention was, that I was giving the promise of the outcome, or like I was sharing with my friend that if I borrow money from someone, always my intention is to pay them back. And then we got to the point where they would ask me, I was indignant that they actually would ask me for it back. So I had a clear idea about intention, how I understood intention, the feeling of it when I was using it. Now I'm sort of rethinking it here today, because it's like what you're saying is that when there's mindfulness, when there's mindful intention, that, you know, that, and we are aware of the consequences and we have a choice, then a lot of things open up and the possibility for however we find happiness lies in that.
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about is what I was talking about my daughter. Like, I meant to clean my room, you know. Yeah, that's the superficial, you know, the famous line, the road to hell is paved by good intentions. Well, those weren't actual, from a Buddhist viewpoint, those weren't the real intentions. Because the what happens in the end, where things lead to, always is an indicator of where they started. Even no matter what we tell ourselves, if you wind up getting drunk, even though you said you meant to only have one drink, what, you know, underlying that was the craving to feel okay, you know, to fix the way you were feeling, and that was the real driving thing. And on top of that, you said, "I want to feel okay. One drink will be enough," kind of, you know, or I just want. So the actual intention was this. Wasn't positive. It was just that we delude ourselves. We lie to ourselves. That's why it's so important to be able to look closely. We deceive ourselves in so many ways. This is one of the reasons why I think meditation is so important in working the 12 steps. Because it's quite easy to work the 12 steps superficially and not really bring an authentic transformation. I don't know if it's easy, but I think it's possible. I think you can miss a lot. Unless you're able to look, you know, that we talk about rigorous honesty. Well, mindfulness is rigorous honesty. It's rigorously looking at your mind and your impulses, your cravings, your feelings. It's, you know, what an order I can't go through with it. You know, it says it's work. Yeah. I mean, that's why, you know, when I was talking about like these books that kind of promise happiness is like, yeah, it's a lifetime's work, isn't it? An engagement in life. And look at what, you know, what's really working in my life? What isn't working? I mean, you know, if I don't think we can, you know, cheat that. Yeah, that we can somehow, like, oh, well, I don't really need that. I was like, yeah. Now, if you don't have some kind of social, if you don't have some kind of healthy, happy relationships, whatever they might, you know, in whatever form, whether they're intimate or they're, you know, spiritual community or something, I don't know how you're going to be happy without some kind of connections. And it's one of the problems for addicts, right? We isolate and we alienate. And I mean, certainly for me, much of my recovery has been about relationship, you know, about intimacy. And you know, I've been married for 17 years, 18 years. And the fact that I got married was a result of the previous 12 years of sobriety, you know. And the fact that I've stayed married is a result of the succeeding 18 years of sobriety. You know, is what, you know, I've had to continue to work on that. I guess I've digressed again, but I'm doing my best. So, I think we should take a break. I'm going to say that someone came up and asked me to talk about higher power. So that tends to be a topic that comes around a lot. So after the break, I will diverge out of happiness and talk about God and how he will make us all happy.